Ave Maria, welcome to another edition of the Children of Mary. We salute our patroness, Saint Philomena. Today we're going to play a couple of interviews following on what we were saying in our program about uniting everyone in the Immaculate Heart of Mary. That there are those who work in different sectors, let's say, they have different camps of battle, whether it be marriage and the family or pro-life. But it's important for us to be Mary's soldiers from whatever camp we are fighting in. Today we'll listen to an interview that helps us understand the battle within the pro-life movement. We'll hear a little bit about the tragedy of what happened to Ireland and how the Philippines could be the next possible target. And we spoke about the Immaculate Heart of Mary. St. John Eudes calls the Immaculate Heart of Mary the Divine Heart of Mary because her heart is united to the heart of her son. And for last week's episode, we have an image of the Eucharistic heart, let's say, of Mary, of the Eucharist in the Immaculate Heart of Mary. We'll hear a little bit about the crisis in the church, how at the heart of the church there is a sickness, and the Eucharist is the way to heal that sickness, to have Jesus at the center. But remembering what we've said in our program, if we put the Immaculate Heart of Mary in the center, given that within her heart there is, let's say, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and we mentioned last week some mystics have even said that the Eucharist is there contained in the heart of Mary. This is the way of healing the church and defeating this ecclesiastical communism, as we'll describe it. And we'll hear our guest, who we interviewed, support, let's say, this terminology of there being this ecclesiastical communism which exists in the church. So we present first our interview in pro-life, and then we have a very eminent and distinguished guest that we were very graced to have interviewed. Ave Maria. Now, I'm here with Father Shannon Bokay, who is the president of Human Life International. We're actually here in Ireland for a weekend of conferences on Humanae Vitae. Now, please tell us a little bit about HLI, Human Life International, how it came about, and what its aims are. What is Human Life International?
Sure. Well, first of all, Human Life International was founded originally as the Human Life Center in 1972 by Father Paul Marx. So Father Paul Marx was a Benedictine priest. He himself was one of 13 children, and you know, very large, beautiful family. And so he realized that as the issues affecting life and family were growing, and especially on the heels of Humanae Vitae, which is what this symposium, these three days have been about, that was promulgated in 1968 on July the 25th. And so when you realize that he saw that this dissent against what God's plan for marriage, the beauty of life and the openness to life, was being threatened. So he founded the Human Life Center as a Catholic educational apostolate to bring the church's teaching to others, to expose what the church has constantly and consistently taught in every age. And then in 1981, realizing that this need needed to move globally, and that because of dissent and false teaching and a lack of catechesis and formation, that we needed to bring the message abroad. And so in 1981, he moved Human Life Center, in a sense of name, to Human Life International. And since then, as in 1979, John Paul II said to Father Marx, that if you bring this message, the gospel of life, to the ends of the earth, then you will indeed be doing the most important work on earth. And that, it really is the core message of HLI's effort, is to bring to bear the beauty of the church's teaching on life and family. And some of our target groups really are, you know, seminarians, formation of priests, continuing education, working with lay faithful, you know, lay leaders, people working in the life and family causes, supporting bishops in their apostolic work in their dioceses on faith and formation, helping them with regarding to marriage formation. So a huge litany. And working also with local leaders. That's our primary work. Like here in Ireland, you know, we work with Patrick McChrystal in HLI Ireland. And this is what we duplicate around the world, recognizing local leaders, empowering them through resources, sometimes educational materials, or it could be even like in Africa, many of the places have no resource of finance. So we provide grants. So money to be able to get their foundations going, to have their work grow. So working with local leaders, which has caused us to have worked in about 160 countries to date, and currently active on each of the continents with directors working in many of the countries. And currently we have an active affiliate office, what we call an office. It's not necessarily a building, but an affiliate or a director in 110 actual countries now. So it's really a tremendous work. And we have an office in Rome, working with the Vatican and having worked with the Academy for Life and, you know, for many years, and been there 21 years, 22 years now, have one of the largest bioethics libraries. So we work with a lot of students studying the issues of life and family. And then we have our Hispanic outreach, which is stationed in Miami, Florida in the United States. So we have a pretty large network and footprint. So it's an amazing apostolate that began with one man with a tremendous vision to carry the gospel, the good news about life and family to the ends of the earth.
Now we'll ask our radio listeners to pray that it continue to grow and to for HLI and that it continues in all its endeavors. Now, you mentioned a next target, which is the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure if it was Father Marx who spoke about when Malta falls, when Ireland falls, and when Philippines fall.
Right.
That's, you know, it's over. But what do you see on the horizon for the Philippines? What was the tactic that's going to be used to try to bring the Philippines down? If you could inform us a little bit.
Well, I think if we can use Ireland as a great example. So if we look at the Catholic countries that you just mentioned, Malta, Ireland, Philippines, these have been bastions of Catholicism. You know, that's been, and so when people look at these countries, they really know that the Catholic Church is a very strong, not institution in the sense of just an institution, but has a very strong foothold in these countries. So when people think of them, they think Catholic Church. And so for Father Marx to recognize that was not saying anything new, but what he was saying is when you look at these countries, and if they themselves falter, if they themselves become complicitous in the actions of the culture of death, that it's going to bring a greater wave of the negative issues on a global scale. And this is absolutely true, because if you look at Ireland, Ireland has had, you know, one of the healthiest maternal care and the beautiful protection of human life. And to see what recently happened with the referendum is basically throwing that to the wind and realizing instead of being a light to the rest of the world, it's basically embraced the culture of death. And many people were elated that they became like Europe. We want to be like Europe. We want to be like Europe. Well, Europe is dying. And why? Because it's embraced this mentality. It's embraced the full slot of the culture of death. So this is why Father Mark said what he said. So if you lose those footholds, then it becomes ever more easy for the culture of death to become greater entrenched in the world. So we look at the tactics in Ireland. So we call them structures of influence. So there are 10, actually. And if you look at them, you know, the way the church influences culture. So if we look at the Gospel of Matthew, our Lord says, you know, be light and salt. So we're supposed to be an infusion of the gospel in daily life, to bring to bear the truth of the gospel in every facet of life, whether we hold the highest civil office of the nation, whether we are the local bishop, the local priest, a mom, a pop, no matter where we are, everywhere we're supposed to bring the gospel and to be light and salt. So the structures of influence is the church and the family. And John Paul said very eloquently, you know, the society passes through the family. So if the family is healthy, strong, vibrant, very Christocentric, Christ-centered, and light and salt for the rest of the culture around, it becomes a tremendous influence in how the society is built, how society grows, what are our values, what are our ethics, what do we hold of greater importance. So when the family is the one that's guiding that conversation, and life is precious, marriage is sacred, all those elements are in place, it's going to influence government, it influences media, it influences medicine, science, you know, all the things we see. Now turn that around. What do we see happening in many parts of the world and here in Ireland? So the other structures of influence are what I just mentioned, government, science, medicine, social media, the whole things that people see in movies, magazines, and all the teaching, education. So what has happened with the culture of death? They have been able to have inroad over the last decades, many decades here in Ireland, like we see in other parts of the world, and now influence UN policies, UN governmental recommendations, Geneva, the organized American states in Latin America. You see where governments, legislator, parliaments, you can see everything that's been influenced. And you think what we call basically a systematic behavioral modification. So what has happened in Ireland? Over the last number of decades, people have systematically been modified in behavior of what they consider of great value. So this whole idea of the acceptance of same-sex union didn't just happen overnight. The whole referendum of rejecting the Constitution here in Amendment 8 didn't just happen overnight. It's been a gradual overtaking of the structures of influence. Think of the universities, the colleges here in Ireland. You know, look at the poison that so many of our young people have been indoctrinated with in those supposedly Catholic institutions. And so this is important for us in strategy as we look at the Philippines, which is, this is already happening there too. Now you have 110 million, 112 million, you know, Filipinos. Now about 100 million or so live in the Philippines. The rest are dispersed around the world. And so you look at the same thing happening. So you look at their Congress, you look at their parliamentary decisions, you look most recently in the Philippines, there was a move to legalize divorce. The only nation right now thus far, you know, that's still standing. And you look at the reproductive health law that happened now a few years ago, that for over almost 13 years, HLI and many others in Philippines fought to prevent from happening. And yet, you know, before the current president came to office, the previous president, you know, through corruption and sadly through the recent Obama administration before, was told if you change the law, money will flow. In other words, so you see what happens. And so these are the structures of influence. Some of the Catholic institutions in the Philippines are actually teaching gender ideology. So these are supposed to be the bastions where that hold down what the church teaches and brings that beautiful teaching within the universities and the colleges and the parochial schools. So as these structures of influence continue to be compromised, what is going to happen? So what's the future going to be? Well, all things can be mitigated, of course, all right? God is God. But at the end of the day, just from a natural progression, so if this current generation and the generation before and the next have been so compromised, well, who are your future teachers? Who are your future doctors? Who are your future parliamentarians? Well, it's the people that have been systematically modified in their behavior. They no longer look at life as precious. They no longer look at marriage between one man, one woman. They no longer look at the Judeo-Christian ethos as a guiding principle in their culture. It's so you see where it's possibly moving and where the Philippines may be in the next 30, 50 years. And that's a danger. And I just met with some local leaders in the Philippines. I was there twice already this year. And we talked about this. And it's very disconcerting because they don't want to believe that. They don't want to say, no, it can't happen. It will never happen here. Ireland, here we are. So this is a shot that has really reminded the people in the Philippines, it could happen here, but it's already happening. See, that's what they don't see. It's already there. The mentality is already there. You look at a population in the Philippines that at one time had, on average, in 1965, about 7 children. Now today, it's barely holding at 3 to 4. So you can see the radical change in the mentality towards openness to human life. Same thing happening here in Ireland. So you look at the numbers and the demographics, and it's a clear sign something has radically changed in the society. So I'm not surprised. I'm very disheartened, very disappointed in what's happened here in Ireland. I'm obviously very concerned about where do we go from here. I'm also very concerned about what may unfold in the Philippines. And so we have to enter into this conversation to expose the lies, expose what's happening. And with all respect to our some members of our church who are in our hierarchy, we need to open our eyes and to see that if we don't intervene and retake the structures of influence, that we have the ability to influence as we always have in every age. If we don't take our own institutions back and change the way that we teach and re-engage the conversation in Catholic teaching, then it's a self-inflicted wound. We're shooting our own selves in the foot.
Thank you. Now, I remember you speaking about things are going to have to happen gradually. This is the frank reality, right, of things. I mean, as you mentioned, we have to take back these structures.
Correct.
We wish that they could be taken overnight.
And they can't.
But it can't.
That's right.
But hearing the situation within these structures, the stronghold,
right,
that, let's say, St. Maximilian would refer to them as the enemies of the church, not in an uncharitable way,
but no, of course,
that they've taken these and it's a stronghold.
Right.
They have a very strong hold on them. One of the things that come to mind is the young seem to be almost the stomping ground, because right, they are the future.
Correct.
They are the ones, as you yourself has mentioned, who, sure, are going to be the future teachers and politicians.
Our leaders, absolutely.
And our leaders. Would you say that is almost primarily, or there's a precedence in going towards them to,
yes,
begin this process of a gradual, right, retaking and,
sure,
conquest.
That's why I'm emphasizing education, our educational institutions, so which could be in our parishes, of course, our catechetical programs and so forth, but especially in our parochial schools, in our colleges, our universities, our higher learning institutions. If we don't take these back. Now, as you said, it's not going to be an overnight issue. But again, we rely upon our hierarchical leaders, so our bishops, our pastors, our superiors of religious institutions. I mean, they have a moral obligation to assure that in these places that consider themselves Catholic, that they are genuinely Catholic and that they are teaching Catholic teaching. And making sure that they are in true compliance with what we identify as Catholic. And that is going to be crucial. And it's going to take oversight. It's going to take commitment. It's going to take maybe years to gradually, because let's be honest, many of the teachers in these places are the ones that are not in line with Catholic teaching. We have non-Catholics teaching in some of these very, very, very important institutions that are promoting non-Catholic teaching, and they're not being challenged. They're not being removed from their positions of influence. So again, we shouldn't be surprised that many of our Catholic young adults today and young professionals don't know their faith. They have no inclination of what the faith is because that's not what they've been taught. And so we shouldn't be so surprised. Oh, how did this happen? So we have to be as aggressive as the other agenda has been so aggressive in taking over those structures. We have to be aggressive with it. And we have to be able to call out these institutions and say to them, you are not Catholic. And if you cannot promote what is Catholic, then I, as the bishop of the local diocese, cannot support you. You don't have a charter to call yourself Catholic anymore. Now, that's going to take courage on many, many levels. And so that's one way. you know, that's going to take. So the universities, the parochial schools, our colleges, our higher learning institutions really need to be pulled back into the beauty of what Catholic education was supposed to be about, to teach the Catholic faith. And, you know, the Catholic Church has been a tremendous contributor to science. And, you know, we look at all the Nobel Peace Prize. How many Catholics, you know, have been part of contributing to all the beautiful things today that we have? And how many of those were priests, you know? So the Church has been a rich contributor, you know, to this conversation. We need to do that again. We need to really contribute to the culture, the beauty of Catholic teaching. And so it's not idealistic. This is not an idealistic conversation. This is a reality. And when many of these institutions were founded, they were founded by bishops and superiors and religious founders who believed in Catholic teaching and wanted to bring that teaching, you know, to many communities and allow the community to grow and to prosper. We need to reclaim that vision again.
Now, I can't take too much time from you, but an image came to mind, which might not be such a good one, of a violent shootout. Mm-hmm. Those, because yes, we speak about the young, because mm-hmm. even what happened in Ireland, you would mention it was right. It was 80% of the young voted right. for that. So we have to really, the young is the future, right. But those who are holding, those who have the power in these structures, there has to be like a reaction from us right. against them, a war, an onslaught mm-hmm. against them. So this is why I had the image of almost like a shootout.
Yeah, we have to. It's in a sense of, I mean, it may not be the proper way to explain, but I think, you know, when you look at this, you know, and I'm just kind of backtrack just for a second, because you mentioned about the young adults that voted in en masse, you know, for this. Well, 1979, John Paul, in his first visit here to Ireland, would have said, I'm 52 years old. So some of these young people that we're talking about, if I had been called to married life, these would be, quote, my children, you know, the age of what my children could be. And so it would have been John Paul talking to me in 1979, my age bracket, saying the future of Ireland rests in your hands. So I think it's a wake-up call. So you're talking about using the language kind of a shootout, but that is the wake-up call. Look at what has happened in that age bracket. But go back before then. You've got to look at the, you know, the 50-year-olds. That would have been my age bracket. Those 20 and 30-year-olds didn't create in a vacuum, all right? So they've been influenced by the previous generation. So the onslaught has been going on now for decades. So it takes a radical shake. And I think that this referendum shows how deep a problem there is spiritually and also in the civil society. So it's both and. Now, to awaken is going to require, you know, our spiritual leaders and our very good civil leaders. We have some beautiful civil leaders who are with us and share the same vision of Ireland and the beauty of life and the beauty of marriage. And so we got to pull together and really recognize that this is a wake-up call. And if we don't intervene, far worse things are yet to come. Because this is not going to just end with the possibility of legalizing abortion. And right now, the intention, based upon what we hear from the Prime Minister and so forth, is to legalize it within a certain period. They call it exceptions. There's no such thing as an exception. Exceptions don't exist. Every life is precious. It is their foot in the door to fully legalize abortion throughout until birth. So this is what they're going to aim for. And then you're going to see where they're going to push euthanasia. You're going to see where the other issues against life are going to come. This is the wake-up call. And if our leaders don't see that, then we're going to see far worse things happen in Ireland. And that's not a scare tactic. That's not a doomsday. It is reality, because this is what we see globally in other Western cultures and other parts of the world. So there's no end, as Mother Teresa of Calcutta called it, the slippery slope. So what do? Let's go back to Evangelium Vitae. So let's talk about what John Paul challenged us in this beautiful encyclical, The Gospel of Life. At the end of the encyclical, he talks about some very important words. In the very beginning, he bookends it with, Paragraph 5, we have to reteach, very important word, and what's beautiful about this radio program, you're doing teaching. You're trying to educate. So we have to reteach. Now, and this is 1981. Why in the world is John Paul in the early 80s saying we have to reteach? Because people don't know their faith. We have to reteach people how to love life, respect life, defend life, and serve life. That's the first bookend. The other bookend is at the end. He says we have to be actively engaged in the campaign for life. So we need to be active. We need to be together, which means we have to be united as a people of faith and a people who believe in the sanctity of marriage and the sanctity of human life. We have to be united in an ethical effort, which means we have to see the good and we have to be united in defending the good. And we have to have the resolve to enter in. We have to persevere. We have to be willing to fight the good fight, to run the race, and to do this actively, united, and together. Now, if we do that, and what he called the Great Campaign for Life, we can recapture the ground that we've lost. And then we can refortify those barriers to prevent any other assault on the dignity of life. And that's why he talks about this so strongly throughout his pontificate, because he saw it. He saw what communism did. He saw what Nazism did. So today, no, this is not communism that's causing this in Ireland. It's not Nazism that's causing this in Ireland, but it's other isms, and they're just as deadly. Rampant individualism, relativism, the whole moral compass has been broken and on people understanding right from wrong. So today they want to call what is good evil and what is evil good. And so there's so much confusion. So this is going to take a radical effort on everyone's part to re-engage the conversation. This is not the time to cower in a corner. And it's not a time, you know, to say, well, what can we do? This is potentially, especially this referendum, that gives the open door to change the Constitution, to legalize abortion in this nation, that would become an unjust law. It's an unjust law because it does not regard the inviolable dignity of every human life. That's an unjust law, and we should not accept any law of that nature. We have the same thing with the issue of same-sex union. So we have a fight on our hand, and not a fight with weapons, not a fight with sword or anything. It's a fight with the truth. We hold the truth. We know the truth. We have to teach that truth. And that's what's going to set people free, and that's what's going to bring Ireland back. That's what's going to reclaim the territory that's been lost. And so my hope is that in all this wonderful conversation that we're all engaged in, that people will see and open their eyes, and indifference is unacceptable. People cannot sit on the sidelines. John Paul said, no one is excused. So you can't say you're too old. You can't say you're too young. You can't say you don't understand. That's an excuse, and it's unacceptable. Everyone in this society has to get involved in the defense of life and family.
Yes. Now, to coming to our conclusion, I had mentioned St. Maximilian Kolbe.
Yes, who I just recently visited in his, well, not him, but obviously visited the cell. Was
great.
On Auschwitz just recently.
Great.
And I've always had a great devotion to Maximilian Kolbe, so.
Now, I like the American frankness. I think it's something we really need, because there's a lot of politically correct and, you know, trying to be diplomatic.
Rhetoric.
You know, rhetoric. But St. Maximilian Kolbe is a great model, I think, because I'm going to be frank about something. I can edit things out if what I say is not so prudent. Those who are in occupation of those structures are the Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
This is also about a war against Freemasons, because we could say much about, okay, we need to educate this, and we need to, which is true. But a war against the Freemasons is needed, because it is them who are in the governments, them who are in the universities, them who can even penetrate people's minds in the church.
Sure.
So this, I propose St. Maximilian Kolbe as a model because he founded the Militia of Mary Immaculate.
That's right.
And consecration to Mary, devotion to Mary.
That's right.
He saw that as being this means of winning the war. And I'd add two things before we conclude, and I'll ask Father for some final words and a little more maybe on the strategy that we can all try to engage in. Two final considerations is we need to bring more grace into the world. What I mean by that is people need to be living in grace because they're able to advance because of sin,
right?
Because people are being unfaithful. So they're able to march forward when we as Catholics are not faithful to our duty. So we need grace to hold off that onslaught and to strike a blow.
Absolutely.
More grace. We need to promote obedience.
It's the universal call to holiness. And so, I agree with you. I mean, the intrusion by those who are violently opposed to the Church, you know, we've seen in century after century. And so today, we should not be surprised that there are groups of peoples that have made their strategy to find inroads into the Church from highest structures and strictures all the way down to radically alter how the Church functions and lives in daily life. So that's, I don't think any of us are going to, I think many people would be surprised to know and maybe think, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. But no, it's real. There are people who are completely opposed to the life and work of the Church and violently work against her, and are atheist, agnostic, and in the